This is the current federal tax developments for the week of May the 27th, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. Ed Zoller is coming here from Phoenix, Arizona, and we're going to be going over a couple of things this week that happened in the area of federal taxes, including two separate court cases where the losing party is arguing that the party that prevailed misled them. And in one case, you know, the court even agreed there was a silence. And in the other case, the court said it didn't really matter, that there was a misleading silence, I should say. In the other case, the court ruled that it didn't really matter, in essence, because of the fact that Congress had explicitly shut off any possibility of equitable tolling for the issue in question. So, interesting week. But before that, we do have a couple other things we're going to look at. First, we're going to talk about yet another private letter ruling that was requested for a misqualified subchapter S trust election after S shares moved to a trust following the death of a shareholder. Talk about this. We've seen related ones that are where we're talking about ESBT elections, but basically the same problem. We're also going to talk about a tax preparer whose conviction for willfully filing false returns was upheld on appeal. Despite the argument that he was doing what he'd done for years in one case, and that he'd never really then proved he'd willfully, filed false returns. It was kind of interesting discussion. We do have letters from the first of our two cases with the courts. This one deals with letters to the taxpayers from the IRS appeals office and the fact that those did not extend the time to file a suit for a claim for refund. So we'll talk a little bit about that. That's a procedural issue you need to be aware of, because basically you can lose your rights. Unlike a case we're talking about going to appeals, in the case of an IRS exam, where there's an assessment date, etc., and there's options afterwards. In this state, it's going to become a little more interesting because the client effectively, or the taxpayer, loses all of her options by the fact that she kept waiting for appeals to handle her matter when, in fact, that wasn't going to happen. So we'll talk a little bit about that issue. We'll also talk about the shoe being on the other foot, where the IRS found that a partnership was held by the tax court to a properly elected to early apply the Bipartisan Budget Act audit provisions, rendering the IRS's basically TEFRA partnership exam invalid and worthless, and it just chewed up time that now they weren't going to be able to go back into a BBA exam and get that completed, and assessments based on that. So it was an interesting question there. It goes to the validity of their election. And even though the taxpayer knew the IRS believed they had denied the election and believed they had the right to do so, the taxpayer just kept quiet about this potential defense. So we'll talk a little bit about it, but taxpayer win. So let's talk first about the private letter ruling problem that I mentioned. This is private letter ruling 2024-21005. This particular one came out May 24th, and really we see ones like this on a very regular basis. And I just want to remind people of the problem we're seeing here. If you work, even if you don't do estate planning work, if you work with S corporations, you need to understand the problem because there is a great risk to your S election as soon as we have a shareholder who dies. And this is a case where the S election did get terminated. Now, the taxpayers were able to get the IRS to rule it was inadvertent retroactively and, correct the problem, but only after they spent the money to get a PLR, which is not an inexpensive move. So in this case, we had a decedent held his S corporation shares in a grantor trust. Now, it very well could have been revocable living trust, but the PLR doesn't state this fact. And the reason why that could be important is with the proper election, that could be treated as the grantor's estate for a time period. But in relevance, it doesn't really matter in this case. But in the actual situations you're working with, that could make a change as to whether we're looking at a trust established at the death of the grantor or we're looking at the grantor's estate, which can make some differences, but we're going to kind of ignore that for now, right, as to how quickly we have to act. When the decedent died, the terms of the revocable living trust probably is what he had, that was holding the shares, was that a brand new trust would be formed for these S shares, and these shares would be transferred to the new trust. Now, this new trust was drafted clearly to allow for a qualified subchapter S trust election by the beneficiary. And honestly, remember, trusts normally cannot hold S shares. They have to meet very special criteria. And for the types of trusts we'd like to actually do something with, right, that aren't simply grantor trusts or that aren't, voting trusts, various other things. So for the most part, if you got kind of a traditional style trust, you're going to either want to go the QSST option, Qualified Subchapter S Trust option, or the Electing Small Business Trust option, the ESBT option. This particular trust was designed to be a QSST. Now, in a QSST, it operates virtually as if the beneficiary holds those S shares directly, effectively virtually like a grantor trust in this purpose, so that every distribution coming from the trust has to go to the beneficiary. The cash goes straight there. If the stock is sold, the proceeds of that has to go to the beneficiary. And the reason for all of this is we still have a trustee that can prevent the shares from being transferred or sold to any other party. So the idea of that is we control where the shares go. That's why we put them to a QSST rather than leaving them directly to, son, daughter, whoever. It could be for divorce protection. It could be for creditor protection. It could be just because mom and dad love to control things from beyond the grave. It was their shares, so they get the right to do it. But in any event, we set up this election. Now, the problem is, while the terms are there, it's not considered a qualified subchapter S trust until an election is made by the beneficiary. The beneficiary has to make this election because, remember, we're going to drop this income onto their return, right? They're going to be participating in this S corporation, and so they have to agree to allowing this to happen. If that doesn't happen, they don't agree. Well, hopefully you've got some provision that the trust is going to be funded if they don't agree, but let's skip that. If it really goes into trust and no election's found, you have a C corp. Basically that trust is wildly unlikely to qualify to hold the shares under any other mechanism. So because of that, you end up with terminating your S election, right? Now, obviously, the attorney that drafted the plan, and this is not something you'll do by accident, right? Somebody had to think this through, that this is what we want to do. The shares will go to this trust. The beneficiary will make a QSST election. So I'm going to assume there's probably legal counsel involved. Legal counsel understood the problem. Legal counsel set up this trust to work perfectly like this. Now, one of the problems, and as you get older in practice, you start noticing this, is that people feel most comfortable with estate planning attorneys who are, especially when they set up their, their estate plans when they're, let's say, in their 30s or 40s, they start thinking about this, they become successful. Well, they want somebody with experience. And that generally means somebody older than them. There's a fundamental problem that tends to happen here. That older attorney, right, is often not in practice or has simply died by the time that this client dies and the shares go in. So now we have, the attorney who knew exactly what should be done is not part of the estate administration, or it could be the kids just don't want to pay an attorney. Never understood why mom and dad paid so much to the attorney. So we don't need an attorney for this. My friend said, they handled their mom's estate, really on the cheap and easy. So there's nothing big here. Whatever happens, somebody ends up doing this, and either the counsel they have doesn't understand the S rules, which is possible, or there is no counsel, which I think is quite often the case. And so everybody just kind of skips by this. So they knew enough to fund the trust, but they didn't know enough to know that, hey, wait, there's another step you were intended to take. And you're not taking the step because nobody's thought of the problem. And the big problem here, if you are a tax professional, a tax preparer, let's say, so you're on the compliance side only for the S corporation, well, you should realize this is a possibility that we got a problem here, right? Now, what sometimes happens, though, unfortunately, is they won't even tell you that the shares went to the trust. They'll just say the shares went to Susan. Susan will tell you the shares went to Susan, despite the fact that they're titled in the trust because, hey, you know, it's none of their problems. You know, it's not an issue. It's going to go this because they did know enough to know the QSST. Basically, you know, it's all going to be taxed to Susan. So we're just going to treat it as going to Susan. Isn't that how it works? Not really. Okay. So the beneficiary did not timely file a QSST election. Generally, that has to be made within the 2 months and 15 days, effectively 75 days, after the shares pass to the new trust, pass to the trust, or the trust becomes otherwise ineligible to hold the shares. So it'd be one of those things. So you're going to make that election. It can look back 75 days, and you just file this election. And if you do so, you're a QSST. If you fail to do so, then back to the day the shares went to the trust, or back to the day that the trust no longer qualified to hold the shares, because there are some provisions to recognize that, you know, some shares may temporarily sit in the trust. If it's established at dad's death, it won't be, you know, elected instantly, or it will allow you to, you know, like I said, elect a USA, basically a grantor trust. It was an irrevocable grantor trust during the beneficiary, during the decedent's, I'll get the term out right, life, to be treated as if it was a decedent's estate who can hold it for 2 years. So basically, yeah, there are various rules that let you have some options there. So there are two ways in, but we're basically retroactively blown if the beneficiary fails to make the election. There are some automatic relief provisions that will work for 3 years following. But in this case, we got to presume they're getting to the PLR. We are past the three-year date. Because they otherwise, what they'll tell you is they will tell you, you know, we'll learn facts would say, well, this should have qualified for the automatic exception. So obviously we are out of we're more than 3 years after the date that the election should have been filed. So because of this, the S status was terminated. Right? Right? In essence, it terminated because not because anybody said we don't want an S anymore, but because we had a disqualified shareholder. Now, the taxpayer was not aware of this fact. So the S Corporation continued to issue K-1s as if there was still a valid S election. And I have no doubt, as I said, the K-1 went to Susie or whoever the person was supposed to get it, right, who actually had it in trust. Because they don't always tell preparers these things, right? So you find out these things. But so everybody reported income as if it was a valid S election. Except, of course, it wasn't an S Corp. That is a problem because you have 3 years of unpaid C-Corp taxes, or more than 3 years of unpaid C-Corp taxes that are sitting out there. We have a bigger problem that by the time somebody finally figures everything out, if the IRS has sent notices initially, you know, we would probably have more than 3 years have gone since that time period started. So people would no longer have the ability to file for refund claims necessarily because it was not, you know, it was just their screw up by treating this as an S when it wasn't, right? It was not a valid S corporation. So that one was a fact that was knowable at the date. It's not a judgment call. It's not the IRS making a decision about law. This is mechanically a very simple decision. But the reality is it's almost never the IRS that comes in and finds this out. In fact, I don't really think I've ever heard anybody relate a case where the service came in and did this. So now the question becomes, so why are they going for a PLR if the IRS doesn't raise this issue? There's this thing called due diligence. And certainly public companies know about it. And they generally do it when they're looking at acquiring a business, right? You know, they're interested, your client's business is very successful. You know, it's been operating for whatever. They want to write this nice, really big, attractive check to buy the company's interest. But before they'll do that, they agree and you allow to come in a due diligence party who quite often, if it's a large public company, will be a basically consulting group from a big four firm that will come out and look for potential glitches. And part of that team will include people who understand S corporation structures, and they are going to look for whether there is a danger here that we have a lot of unpaid C taxes because we don't have a valid S election. They're going to try to confirm the validity of the S election. And that quite often is when they uncover these things. Hey, you know, Harry died, right? And it went to Susie. Okay. Well, how did Harry transfer the shares to Susie? Oh, it was a trust. Okay, good. And that trust, okay, thank you. We now see the trust document. Okay, good. It looks so far. We see the QSST provisions in there. It looks great. Okay, show me the QSST election. That's where everybody goes, what? It's like, was there a QSST election made? What is that? Quick answer is no. It's going to be the answer since they're asking that question. And suddenly you're in the process of having to get a PLR. Because one thing, as I've said more than once, that public companies don't like to do is take on any level of risk, right? They will not absorb a risk they didn't create, right? If somebody else created the problem, they're not going to step in and be potentially on the hook for parts of it. And if they acquire the assets and bankrupt the corporation, knowing that the corporation has this big unpaid liability, and they've taken all the assets and know that the sellers are taking all the cash out, they're going to worry they could be pulled in to some form of transferee liability situation. They're going to worry about that's a problem, right? They're not going to want that problem with them. So essentially, what they're going to do is say, nope, you got to get this fixed. Therefore, we go for the private letter ruling. That's also why it's more than 3 years since it's been discovered, because this comes way down the line. Now, they applied for a PLR, and the IRS agreed to treat it as an inadvertent termination. So that's the good news. The bad news, of course, is the cost of the PLR. There's not only the user fee, which, depending upon the size of the entity, can be fairly significant, but there's also professional assistance. And if it was the due diligence team that found it, it's likely they're going to insist that that team be put in charge of getting the PLR. Right, getting a PLR, getting it cleared up, and then they're going to present that bill to the S corporation, who now that's your concern. The S corporation is going to turn around and say, "Why didn't you tell us about this?" And they're going to present the bill to you. Not great, right? Now, this is a problem because I have seen a large increase in these requests recently. We've seen these PLR requests go up dramatically recently. And I suspect one of the problems is with the changes in the, basically, the estate tax rules, the amount you can transfer tax-free, I'm guessing that a lot of estates that used that in the past would have had to get an attorney involved because there was a 706, there were all these things to deal with, there were all these problems, and there'd be an exam. So they'd have somebody who is basically both an attorney and a tax advisor who were skilled in working through these things, including the QSST and ESBT elections. And now we're seeing a lot more people kind of wing it on their own and potentially use only a tax preparer who may have no real background. Because again, the number of CPAs, EAs, et cetera, that are regularly dealing with, you know, taxable estates, 706s, and, you know, the trusts, et cetera, and other devices set up coming off of those is going down. You know, somebody who came into practice in the past 10 years may very well never have gone near a 706. They may see some historical trusts, but were never involved in funding them, right? So it is becoming, you know, very, very likely that we're going to find that a lot of preparers have no clue about this issue. But if you are doing S corporations, be aware of it. And that's especially true because you have an old estate plan that moves the shares in there that they're likely to use. And by the way, the moving the shares into a trust for the S is most often done to isolate and for liability protection, not really for an income tax issue. So the odds are we're going to keep using these, and that's where a huge danger comes in. If you do have that, make sure your clients also are S corporations. Talk to their shareholders. Ask what happens when you die to these shares. You know, if the S corporation doesn't know, you know, how the method's going to work. And if there is a trust involved, then suggest, look, you know, we need to make sure this is going to work right. And also consider adding provisions in the S corporation, you know, the stock agreement to make sure that if stock does go to a entity that is not allowed to hold it, that the S corporation will grab. But you need to be proactive here, because I'm beginning to suspect there's just a lot fewer professionals who are used to dealing with this issue that are getting involved in these estates when S corporation shares pass. And that's causing us a big S issue. Said it's likely the attorney that was originally drafted it was no longer involved with the estate. As I said, could have retired, could have died, right? You know, various things. And it's getting tougher and tougher to find replacement counsel, right, who can step in and do this. And so it may have very well been that this was an attorney who, you know, when his practice shut down, he really couldn't find anybody to refer or to suggest people go to. We've seen that a lot. And it's a little more interesting trying to find somebody to step in and take care of stuff, you know, and that's just the way it works. And also, if you are involved, I think this should go attorney, you should pay attention to this one too. It's really important to set out clearly, you know, what the steps are involved with the mechanisms you've chosen. Don't just assume that they are going to have you there, or even if they go get counsel, they're going to have counsel that understands this issue. Make it very clear that, you know, at the first death, and tell them to hold on to this, right, and make sure your heirs have this document. At that death, the shares go to the trust, but it's crucial to keep the S-Corp election in place that the beneficiary must make this election. If the beneficiary refuses to make this election, notice the terms on the other estate planning documents that says the shares just don't go to them, right? The shares don't go to the trust unless they agree to make the election. You know, get stuff along that route. Next up, we got a criminal case, United States versus, in this case, Mader. It's an Eighth Circuit case, docket number 23-2258, came out on May the 23rd. Now, this prepare has a few issues. What got the IRS's attention was they became aware that he was routing tax refunds for his clients into his own personal account. Yeah, it's kind of interesting that the same account is getting all of these refunds. That raised a red flag to the IRS saying, hey, this isn't right. We need to go talk to this guy. When they went out and took a look at his practice, they found a whole bunch of other issues, right? Including the ones we're going to talk about today that got him facing criminal charges and a criminal conviction, which has now been sustained on appeal. He had a pattern of reporting unreimbursed business expenses and refundable education credit on a huge proportion of his clients' income tax returns. Unnaturally large proportion, which got them really interested in, well, you know, now either this guy has a really weird client base, or is he just inventing these? And quite often people get picked up with that. Didn't mention it's here, but the ones I remember, some I've heard about who've gotten convicted similarly, they tend to love to use the same numbers. I mean, you know, I might as well do it quickly. You know, you if you're going to use fake numbers, why spend a lot of time on them? Just use the same thing, right? One example was a couple where he basically listed $26,000 in business expenses and got them a education credit. Neither was in college, and he never asked them about if they had business expenses. He just had nice $26,000. Of unreimbursed business expenses on the return and an education credit. And this was not unusual in his practice. A lot of his clients had these sorts of things appear on their return. Okay. Now, he, of course, said, okay, all this data is in front of a jury. At trial, he's convicted by a jury who says, you willfully basically, you know, filed false returns. You misrepresented information on returns that you knew was misrepresented. And you did that willfully. And he said, wait, there was no evidence of, you know, that I had willfully done so. And of course, I'm sure his theory is, well, you know, in order to show it was willful, they'd have to prove I knew it. And they had to prove that, and I knew it was wrong. And I had, you know, and I acted out of my own will. And of course, well, that requires mind reading, and they can't do that. So unless I say that's true, they couldn't convict me. That's not quite how the world works. And the Eighth Circuit panel pointed that out to him, right? They said the jury is allowed to reasonably infer willfulness from your actions and other evidence before the jury. And in fact, basically, they had, you know, a couple come up and said he never asked about their expenses or asked to look at receipts. He just put a number on the return, right? So that number was there. And like it or not, a lot of clients don't look at the return. So it's possible, and I'm sure the clients claim that here, because otherwise, you know, you worry about the fact that you were part of this. But, you know, they claim they were asked. And what really hurt, to be honest, was the second one there. On another case Yaris brought up as a fraudulent return, he had admitted he had adjusted numbers to get the result he wanted, right? But he said that's okay because he had been doing that kind of adjusting of numbers on the fly. By the way, adjusting numbers means lying, right? Faking, you know, getting the right number to make things work. He had been doing it for years, so obviously that means, I'm not sure what it means in his mind, but he thought it meant something important, you know, that he was there. It did, as the jury noted. It means you knew exactly what you were doing. And the jury wasn't going to buy this theory that he didn't know that was wrong. They're saying, nope, you're holding yourself up as an expert. You should have known this was wrong. You know, we're 12 people with no, or however many was on the jury, you know, with no tax training at all, and we figured out it's wrong, right? We have no trouble figuring out you shouldn't do that. So we can't believe you're such an idiot, right? Which, by the way, is one of the defenses that comes there. Yes, if you're so stupid, you don't understand what you did wrong, you don't understand that what you do is illegal, then it's tough to get a criminal conviction, especially in tax areas. That goes back to the John Cheek case, which was U.S. Supreme Court. But the sad part for Mr. Cheek was that on retrial, the jury didn't believe he could be that stupid. So it's kind of a positive defense. I'm that stupid. And the jury said, no, no, Mr. Cheek, you're not that stupid. So he ended up being convicted anyway. But anyway, the Cheek defense wasn't going to work here either. It was one of those backgrounds, right? The appellate panel refused to overturn the conviction. And key issue takeaway here, and this is one reason why I want to remind you of this. Just because something has been done for years, just because the IRS has never questioned something for years that is clearly wrong under the code, this is not going to justify. Just because you went through an exam last year and this issue wasn't raised by the service does not mean that you can just keep doing it if you become aware that the position is not supported by the law. Now, hopefully it wouldn't be so bad that you end up like in this case, the preparer here that ends up, you know, basically with a criminal conviction for filing false returns. But, you know, be aware of that because I hear all too many times people do it, you know, well, that's impractical. They never look at that. It's like it's impractical until they actually start looking at it. And no, you're not going to get out of it just because the IRS for years never looked at this issue. If the law clearly says you need to do X, you need to do X. And the fact they're just not enforcing it in the past is no guarantee it will be enforced in the future and is no excuse for you doing it, right? If somebody challenges you, that's a problem, right? You need to be aware of that. As I said, the IRS doesn't ever really seem to question S status, but that's not going to help you in that civil lawsuit when your client, who's paid just a really big bill to get that S, to get that PLR, you know, and the consulting for it from a big four firm, when they're coming after you for that bill, it's going to help. Okay, next up, we're going to talk about two cases where the winning taxpayer or the winning side appeared to arguably be misleading, or at least you could see how the other side felt they were misled, you know, by the first party. And, you know, but the court still sided with the party who had kind of misled them, or at least not said something that you might have thought, well, you should have mentioned this at this point. So the first one here deals with a claim for refund issue, right? This one is going to take a look at the case of Moy versus United States. It's United States District Court for the Northern District of California, docket 523 CV03151. The opinion came down on May 21st of 2021. This is looking at the deadline for taxpayer filing a suit for refund against the IRS under Section 6532. Now, generally, the government has what's called sovereign immunity. That is, they can't be sued unless they have agreed that they can be sued. And 6532 is a provision that allows the sovereign, in this case, the IRS, you know, the Treasury, et cetera, U.S. government, to be sued under if certain conditions are met for income tax or tax issues in general. So 6532 is key. In this case, it's a bit of a messy thing because quite often these things are. But she'd filed a claim for refund of foreign tax credits for foreign taxes that related to a return that the IRS had found she failed to timely file. This was her 2008 return. She filed her claim for refund in, I think it was, 2019? It was weird. The IRS assessed the tax in 2011. So we got a whole bunch of back and forth going here as to what's going on. Right, 2011 for the 2008 tax year, and she filed her claim for refund in 2018. Now, before somebody thinks, well, we're just obviously clearly out of statute to begin with, it's a little messier than that because there are foreign tax credit statutes is open for 10 years. In some cases, this is messy because she did have the tax already assessed, and you know, yeah, I mean, it's a whole mess of kind of a messy statute case anyway, but she's going to make it into a slam dunk for the IRS here shortly. Okay? Because she'll be clearly outside of any possible statute by the time this finally comes to a head. Okay, so she filed her claim in 2018. The IRS denied the claim, said it was time barred. And certainly it was going to be close, right? In the 2008 return, if the 10-year statute was open, it was going to be open for much longer, right? So again, we're going to go down that path, but they denied it. We don't go into too many facts about that denial. But let's talk about filing a claim for refund. Amended returns and that sort of thing is what you may think of, but technically all of that is under 6532. An amended return is asking for a check. That is a claim for refund, right? So what's our time frame for filing claims for refund? Well, generally, there's a pair of them. We're going to deal with the later one here because we're well past the first one. Right. Generally, you can file a claim for refund, your claim for refund. Right. Okay. Well, you can sue the government. Right. We're talking about going to court to sue to get the money back. Okay. And so Section 6532 covers this. And 6532A1 deals with suits by the taxpayer for refund. Right. And this is the provision that opens it up. If we take a look at this now with the highlighted section, this gives us the basic rules, which you probably have heard the rules listed for you before, but you may never have looked at the statute that does it. You cannot file suit against the government for a refund for taxes. That's a starting point, right? Right? For any internal revenue tax, penalty, or other sum shall be begun. You can't file the suit before the expiration of 6 months from the date of filing the claim required under such section, unless the secretary renders a decision thereon within that time. Okay, let's piece that sentence apart and put it in chronological order. Whenever you have a claim for refund against the United States and for income taxes or any tax under the Internal Revenue Code, you must first file an administrative claim. That's why you can't just go straight to the district court and say, I want my money back. You have to ask the government for the money back. Now, the government has no real deadline to respond to that. Realize that right away. This is going to be one of those things that those people currently stuck waiting for employee retention tax credit claims. Yeah, that's your problem. That's why they can sit them as long as they have. There really is no statute for them to act, except note, if they've had it for 6 months, then you can file suit in court. Now, that would be the way to force the hand, as I would point out to people, if you talk about your ERC credit, well, you could force their hand by suing them right now. So you file suit, the district courts, you know, start scheduling trials, start scheduling dates and everything. And that could force the IRS's hand. You know, they can't ignore it forever. But you know how expensive it would be. Now, this is also where we get into the whole concept of a protective refund claim. It revolves around the fact that you filed within the relevant time frame. And again, that claim for refund under the Internal Revenue Code generally has to be filed for income tax claims within, you know, 2 years after the date the tax was paid, or 3 years after the due date, 3 years after the return was due, you know, or was actually filed, you know, was actually filed, it filed before the due date, filed, you know, by the due date. So basically it's 3 years from the due date or 2 years from the date that the tax was paid. You can recover either way. So you first have to do that, right? You file that up there. And a protective claim, the IRS just sits on that claim because you asked them to. Now, true, you have a right to go to court after 6 months, but if you've got a protective claim, you probably want to wait for whatever contingency we're waiting upon to be resolved before anything moves forward. So that's the concept of protective claim, and why they work is under here. Now, as I should point out, protective claim, you have the right to go straight to court for 6 months, and the IRS has a right to disallow the claim. But it's in both of your interests to do neither until the thing that would resolve it is just taken care of. So that's the background there. So there it is. So you got to wait 6 months. Okay. Well, she had a denial. You know, we're going to talk about this. So she had a denial of a claim back there in 2018, right? Her claim, or 2019, her claim was denied. So, or 2018, I guess, or she had the denial claim then. We'll get into the timing here shortly. So she has the denial. So she has 2 years from the date the IRS writes back and says, you know, good morning, taxpayer. We have your claim for refund. Sorry, we're not going to pay it. Right? For whatever reason, we're not going to pay it. She has 2 years then to go to the district court. Now, the problem we'll discover is that's not what she did. We'll talk about what happened there. Right? Because you also cannot file the claim more than 2 years from the date of mailing by certified registered mail by the secretary to the taxpayer for notice disallowance as of the part of the claim to which the suit proceeding relates. So you can either go to court, right? You can force it to court 6 months after you file your claim. But if the IRS does deny your claim at any time, you now have a 2 year clock running to file your claim for refund. That 2 year or file the suit in district court or the court of claims to, you know, prosecute your suit against the U.S. government. After that date, sovereign immunity stops the lawsuit. So that's what we're looking at here for her. So let's talk about her case. Right? Denial of the claim took place on August 1st of 2018. The taxpayer filed a protest with IRS Appeals Office in November of 19. Now, right away, you should see that she let a year go by plus before she brought up the issue with appeals, the Office of Appeals. That's suggests she's not the quickest on the draw, not moving quickly, but she did decide to go through appeals. Probably somebody told her that the cost of going to court, I think the amount here we're involved in was under $40,000. And to be honest, it might be very difficult to, even if you won, you know, unless you got an award of attorney's fees to make the cost worth that, you're going to pay a significant amount of attorney's fees probably to try the case. And it could conceivably, depending upon how messy things are, this will go way back. Facts will be interesting to find. She may not be the most cooperative of, you know, she's certainly not the most prompt at doing things. She didn't file a return. She was told about that in 2011. They assessed her the tax. She finally got around to saying, hey, well, you know, I should have had this offset 7 years later. It's like, so obviously there are a lot of reasons why her going to court might not have been the smartest way to go, right? So he did that. Now, appeals will respond to her letters during this time, right? Once in December 2019, shortly after she filed it, and then again in February of 2020, they responded saying they were looking at the matter and they would respond to her within 60 days. We all know about that letter. We all know they never respond within 60 days, right? You'll just, at best, as they did this time, you'll get another 60-day letter, right? We finished our 60 days. Voila, we need another 60 days. Okay? So she heard from that. But then she didn't hear from them again until in January of 2021. Then they finally responded saying they denied the appeal because she had failed to file a suit timely, so the appeal was moot. Why? Because, of course, it's now after, essentially, August 1st of 2020, meaning she's outside. She cannot file a petition in the district court, and so the right for her to claim against the government just got shut down. She lost her chance because she didn't file suit within the two-year period after her claim was initially denied. Of course, she thinks this is horribly unfair. Right? But here's a couple of key provisions. We showed you 6532A1. Let's take a look at A2. A2 says, the two-year period prescribed in that first paragraph we read earlier shall be extended for such period as may be agreed upon in writing between the taxpayer and the secretary. So one option here is, if you want to give appeals time to do this, you would approach the IRS and say, look, I'm going to file this suit unless you agree to extend the time frame for me to file suit to give time for appeals to act on this, right? And you would negotiate that agreement. She never did that, right? Rather, she had these letters, and of course, in her mind, she's saying, well, you know, they should extend it because they kept telling me they were going to process this and give me a decision. You know, then they delayed the decision until after the 2 years, so I was disadvantaged. But here's where there's a problem. A4, reconsideration after mailing of the notice. This is an important part of this, and this is why going to appeals the way she did was dangerous. Because what it says is any consideration, reconsideration, or action by the secretary with respect to such claim following the mailing of a notice by certified mail, registered mail of disallowance shall not operate to extend the period within which suit may be begun. That provision is going to turn out to be her problem. Okay, what happened? Well, she argues, look, fairness here, guys. The IRS had my appeal. The Office of Appeal had this. The Office of Appeals obviously knew about the two-year deadline, right? In theory, right? They work with it all the time. You know, they knew that they could extend the statute. They could have approached me and said, look, we won't be able to get to it. So either you need to file your suit because we're not going to deal with it. We're not going to give you an extended time period, or we are going to allow you to extend it till we can deal with the issue. And then you'd have time, you know, some agreed upon time after that to go ahead and file your suit if you decide to do so. That seems fair, right? That seems equitable that you should do that because the government in her mind had basically should have informed her, right? That there was something going on, you know, should have done something. But the problem is, as the opinion finds, it doesn't matter if this fact pattern is or is not subject to equitable tolling, because Congress explicitly blocked the use of their particular reason. So even if you might be able to equitably toll this, and they do have a bit of a quick discussion in the opinion about some question about that on 6532 different parts, and whether it is a stat, whether this particular situation would allow for an equitable relief in certain cases, but they're saying, regardless, even if this would be open for potential equitable relief, Congress has explicitly told us this can't be the reason, right? So it doesn't matter whether or not, because the IRS and she spent all kinds of times arguing whether equitable relief was or wasn't available, and the judge in this case, writing his opinion, simply said it doesn't matter. It could be available, but it wouldn't help you, because Congress can bar specific equitable relief outlets. And they did that here, right, in this case. Thus, she could not file suit to challenge the IRS regarding her refund. She'd lost the right to do it. Now, lots of things are useful to check here. First, obviously, the taxpayer not filing a return is never a good thing. The taxpayer getting her notice in 2011 for tax due and apparently paying the tax off that notice in 2011 is not great. For some reason, it was suggested in 2018 that she look into this, probably because somebody mentioned the 10-year statute on foreign taxes. And so she decided to do it. But the problem is, you know, you're doing these sorts of claims, especially at right in the statute. You're really going to need to have some advisors and advisors dealing with the quirky things of her weird history of this case and whether or not that really does have an open statute at this point or whether it all goes back to, you know, everything being finalized supposedly with whatever she did back in earlier year. But that's not a fact for us to worry about here as to whether she could file suit on this issue. So it's not a matter before the court. It would be if she actually got it to court, but she actually can't get it there. So that was her problem. You know, yeah, be careful here. And I know the other reason is, you know, let's say, and this is something that EAs and CPAs, you know, except for the few who are authorized to practice for the tax court, and even that wouldn't really help here because this has to be a district court filing. You know, you tend to want to use the tools you have. And since you can't go to district court and represent the taxpayer, you may be tempted to go ahead and try to go through appeals. But you got to be aware of the fact that, you know, in a case like this, you are facing a deadline and court may be the only way to keep your rights open. And if you are involved in this and you're the party that recommended, you know, that we keep waiting on appeals, you may find yourself being potentially facing litigation over this refund she claims she would have got anyway. And which you probably told her she qualified for. That's why you're representing her in appeals, right? Yeah. Be very, very careful of these cases. Understand statutes. And make sure that you don't let a statute die like this one did. So, that seems like the IRS misled her, arguably, and they still win. The bad guys win. Let's turn to when the taxpayer misleads the IRS. And there's even a finding in this case. The first case, there was no finding IRS misled her. In this case, the court will actually find that by staying silent, you know, they essentially kind of effectively did a misrepresentation by staying silent and letting the IRS just go ahead and do things that didn't matter, that were wasting time, and allowing and not pointing out they should have been doing something totally different. So this is a case of S.N. Worthington Holdings, LLC versus Commissioner. It is a reported case, 162 TC number 10, May 22nd, 2024. This case is not so important because you're going to hit this exact fact pattern again. You're not. You know, we're not going to be electing into the BBA audit regime in a prior year, except under really weird circumstances these days. But it does tell you how to be careful about reading things and being aware of what's going on. And it was also the taxpayer being very aware of what they were doing. And yeah, it's kind of high risk what they did, because I could certainly have seen the tax court going the other way. You know, it's going to all depend on, as we'll discover, whether or not estoppel comes into play or not here. Now, when we passed the BBA partnership audit procedures in 2015, Congress had it become effective in, as I recall, 2018. But they did say that if an exam opened up after the date that the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015 was signed into law, any exams opening after that date, there may have even been ones that were still open, a taxpayer had a right within 30 days after being notified of an exam, the TEFRA exam, to essentially elect to have that come under the BBA procedures, right? So that was it, right? So we could opt into that. Congress allowed that opt-in and essentially said the IRS will publish rules on how to do that. Those rules are found in Treasury Regulation 301-9100-22B2 is where we're going to find the election. And we're going to be specifically interested in this case in the statements that are required. Like a lot of elections, you know, the taxpayer has to attach a statement to the return or file a statement with the service that contains certain representations. And the taxpayer, or in this case, somebody authorized to represent the partnership and act for the partnership, would sign the document under penalties of perjury that this is true and correct to the best of their knowledge. And that's what we found here. Now, inside of all of this is a specific representation that is referenced at Treasury Regulation 301-900.-22B2II(E4). And what that representation states is that you must represent when you sign it, the partnership has sufficient assets and reasonably anticipates having sufficient assets to pay a potential imputed underpayment with respect to the partnership taxable year that may be determined under subchapter C of chapter 63 of the Internal Revenue Code as amended by the BBA. So in essence, the IRS wants to make sure if you're going to say, oh yeah, examine the partnership, and if there's any balance due, the partnership then will have the right to pay it via imputed adjustment. Well, they're saying, we're not going to let you do that unless you tell us the partnership will have enough assets to be able to make that payment. Now, in this case, the partnership filed on a timely basis what was going to be Form 7036, within 30 days of getting notice that their TEFRA exam starting. They filed Form 7036. This was for the 2016 return. And that contains in it that representation, signed under penalties of perjury by a representative of the partnership. So the IRS obtains this form, and they begin to look at it. And they looked at the tax returns that had been filed. And, you know, they knew the issues they were considering. Almost certainly they had an idea there where an assessment could come. And they decided that based on the partnership returns they've seen, they have, that the partnership would never have sufficient assets to be able to pay the assessment. So what they said was, look, you don't have sufficient assets. And so what they did is they said, we're going to give you 30 days to provide us evidence that you could pay any imputed underpayment that might arise in this exam. The taxpayer did not respond to that. So the IRS notified them after the 30 days had expired that the agency had rejected their election and was going to continue the exam under TEFRA rules. The taxpayer again stayed silent, but they did participate in the TEFRA exam, and they signed documents that referenced TEFRA procedures as part of the exam. However, when the IRS issued the final partnership administrative adjustment notices, which is the end of a TEFRA exam and where we can go and challenge what they did at the partnership level, and then we go on to the individual assessments. Now the partnership goes to tax court and says, hey, wait a minute. This is an invalid final partnership, administrative adjustment, invalid FPAA. It's invalid because we made a valid election to file to have this exam go under the BBA exam, and this is not how you terminate a BBA exam. And they didn't do the right process and get the right extensions of statute, I'm going to presume, because there's lots of issues there. So the tax court, the IRS said, wait a minute. So the IRS says, no, we rejected this. The tax court then went back and they agreed with the taxpayer that, in fact, the taxpayer had fully complied with the regulations. Right? They had made a valid election. It fully complied with the regulations. And therefore, on initial review, the election is, in essence, was valid, and the IRS just fouled up and conducted the wrong exam. It's now too late to go back and restart BBA, it appears. So, partnership, you get out of this with no changes. All the partners aren't going to have to pay any money. The world is great if you're the taxpayer. IRS, not so. The regulations, as written, only required the representation be made and did not provide for any mechanism for the IRS to reject an election so long as it complied with those representation rules. Right? It never said the IRS had a right to ask for additional information, ask for proof that the statements were correct. It just asked for the statements under penalty of perjury. And that they had that. It's in their hand right now. They admitted they got that timely. Okay. Now, there is one other option, though. Right? And they said, okay, I should skip one more thing. The IRS tried a couple of arguments. They said, well, obviously, we have to be able to verify that they could pay it, because otherwise it goes against the whole BBA position, right? In essence, that's there. If they don't have the assets to do it, then this appears to be just a way to try to avoid ever paying the tax when there's an assessment, because it'll go to what will be effectively a totally insolvent LLC that would never have, and none of the partners have to pay the tax afterwards. But the court noted that the BBA had presented, which it does, that deals with a partnership that goes bankrupt, belly up, etc. And there's an imputed adjustment that, in essence, that passes out to the partners and they get a chase it there. So they did not agree with the IRS that being able to ask for proof of that was required essentially to basically not frustrate the purposes of the Bipartisan Budget Act. That's not required. You know, nobody has to do that. You know, right now you just have to be BBA unless you opted out. So, you know, it's not really an issue. They also said if there is ever doubt about the meaning of a regulation, when the IRS wrote it, you wrote it, we interpret the most strictly against you. Because you had the right to write it, the taxpayer had no influence in writing it. Now, that is the reverse of what we've heard many times when taxpayers tried to argue substance over form. It's like, you controlled the form, tough luck, right? IRS didn't have anything to do with it, you did, so you got to live with it. This is just the reverse of that on regulations. IRS wrote them. The taxpayer sitting in front of it had no ability to, you know, negotiate the rules, so we're under your rules. We're going to interpret those rules strictly against you. Now, they did say equitable estoppel was another argument. The IRS said, look, these guys let us along all this time, did not raise any fuss whatsoever about the TEFRA audit being invalid until they'd already run out the clock. Similar to the other case where effectively the IRS ran out the clock, right? The clock was over and then they said, hey, surprise, you didn't do the right exam. Now, to be equitable estoppel, you know, there has to be a few things involved. And the court walks through these. One of them is there must be a misleading representation by the partnership. Okay, they said, well, that first test is met. The partnership knew, the IRS believed that, you know, that this was a valid one. You cooperated with the TEFRA exam, and the only reason for doing so was effectively, you know, to keep the IRS thinking that was okay, right? There's no other reason to keep going with this exam. It's invalid, right? Your position is it's invalid. So why would you keep cooperating with an exam that's invalid? You intentionally, you know, decided not to say anything about your election and not fight it. You give yourself the run out the clock option, right? They'll burn all this time on a TEFRA exam, and we'll then come back in and said, nope, we said it should be BBA. Okay, so that was unfair. We can accept that. However, here's the problem. Was the IRS already aware of the fact that wasn't provided to them? Were they aware of the true facts? And also, was this a question of fact and law, or was it a question of just the law? And the court found that the IRS already had all necessary information to determine if the BB election was valid in their hands. They had no right to ask for backup. They already told you the way the law would apply. So they had all the data in front of them, right? And so because of that, it was a question of law. Did their regulation, had the taxpayer followed their regulation or not? Because it was a screw-up by them in applying the law to facts that are not in dispute, they're perfectly aware of this. You know, they're perfectly aware of this election. They're perfectly aware of this. They assumed that the taxpayer accepted it had to be a TEFRA partnership, but they never actually took a look at that, never, you know, forced the issue, never did any of that background. So taxpayers' right. Now, I would warn you, though, before going too far down this path, you find something similar. It's not raised here because it's not relevant to whether or not the election was valid. But remember, that representation was signed under penalties of perjury. Obviously, there is a theoretical possibility, especially if you knew what you were doing, right? We knew that representation was false, or we should have known it. That opens up the possibility of a criminal prosecution for perjury. So, not sure that this works well unless you can show that the taxpayer was that dumb. We're back to that from the second thing this week. right? You know, was the guy signing that dumb and didn't understand it? You know, that'd be the issue. But if they're aware that that's true and they're trying to game the system, then yeah, there would be a perjury risk here. How big a one? Not terribly sure, but there would be one. So you'd always want to say with the client, you know, you are signing under penalties of perjury. So in theory, if they could show you knew you're lying, you knew this wasn't true, then, you know, you could be on the hook for a perjury charge. So unlikely, but still possible. So be aware of that. Well, this has been the Current Flow Tax Developments for the week of May the 27th, 2024. Current Flow Tax Developments are brought to you by Capital Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers. My email address, edzollers@currentflowtaxdevelopments.com. You can put questions there. I also follow the discussions on the Connect accounts for the Arizona Society of CPAs, New Jersey Society, Illinois Society, Minnesota, and for Washington, along with Idaho. So I think I got everybody in there. So if you're a member of any of those societies, you can post their Connect sites. And if I see your message and think I can help, I may jump in and answer then. Otherwise, watch for us next week. We'll see what else goes on the area of taxes and discuss the updates and developments of current federal tax developments.